Have you tried using Hired? If you haven't, you're missing out. Hired makes it ridiculously easy for designers and developers to find new jobs. Sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute. It's totally free. And you'll get 5 or more interview requests per week, all with salary and equity listed up front. Hired works with a bunch of employers, over 3,000 in fact, that range from startups to large public companies. They're based all over North America and Europe, in 13 of the major tech hubs, and many of them are looking for full-time and contract employees. So basically, there's a really good chance you'll find a great fit. After you do find that great fit through Hired, they'll give you a $1,000 bonus to say thanks for using them. But if you sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute, they'll double that bonus and give you $2,000 instead. Go check them out today. Our second sponsor is Dev Bootcamp. If you're just getting started with development or thinking about getting started, you should check them out. Dev Bootcamp is a short-term immersive software development program. Now, what does that mean? Basically, they provide a 19-week curriculum, 9 weeks part-time remote, 9 weeks on-site immersive training, and then an optional week of career prep. During that time, you'll be learning about things like HTML, CSS, JavaScript, Ruby, and Ruby on Rails. So that's front and back-end stuff, and you'll also get experience working with a team. Dev Bootcamp has 6 campuses located across the United States and is currently accepting applications. Visit devbootcamp.com/doesnotcompute to learn more.
I'll just ask you if you what kind of man you are. Are you a control D man or are you a control C man?
We should probably...
So, Paul, have you read the RubyOnRails.org doctrine article yet?
Yeah, you know, I've glanced through it.
How many times did it take you to read through the whole thing?
Like 4 or 5. It's a little dense. That might not be the right word, but it's a little difficult to get through.
I mean, he really likes this stuff. It's pretty evident that he's really into this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess nobody can blame him after, what, I think 12 years or something working on it. You got to be passionate about something to stay working on it for that long. So that is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think my favorite thing about this article where he talks about the optimize for programmer happiness. And the example was Herb and how you can quit by typing exit or quit versus Python where you have to use... Control D.
Yeah, you can use exit with parentheses or Control D. And his issue with that is that it actually presents a message to you when you just type exit without parentheses. It says, in order to exit, here's how you have to do it. So it clearly knows what you're trying to do, but just won't cooperate, even though it understands. I don't know, it's kind of interesting. It seems like a little bit of a cheap shot to me, but as somebody who's been working with Python a lot lately, that does get me literally every time I fire up a Python console.
So do you just start typing exit a bunch of times until you actually read the message?
No, I type exit and hit enter, and then I'm like, yep, Control D. Even when I know beforehand that I need to hit Control D because I was just in one or something, I still type exit just because... I'm used to being able to type exit, not just in IRB, but also just in general, like in a terminal when I'm in a bash or SSH session. That's just something I do a lot.
I instinctively hit Control C all the time everywhere. So if I were in the Python shell, I would hit Control C maybe 6 times, and then I would finally read the message at the bottom after getting angry. It's really dumb, but it's something that I do.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what makes people fast as programmers is that muscle memory. So then when it gets thrown off in that sort of way, even a ridiculous kind of way, it can slow you down and it can like make your brain have to work harder, which is absurd, but true.
Yeah. Another like aside, I guess, pro tip is if you haven't yet, you should map your caps lock key to control. You should do that.
There's also another setup you can do in that vein. But Brett Terpstra talks about this in one of his blog posts, and we can get a link to that in show notes. But you can map caps lock to, instead of being control, you can have it be shift, control, option, command. So that way you basically get like an entirely new meta key.
What? I didn't even know you could do that.
Yeah, it's a thing, and it's pretty awesome.
I'm going to have to try that. But aside from the Optimize for Programmer Happiness, was there anything that you thought was particularly interesting or any takeaways?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that kind of stuck out to me right near the beginning was the Python argument, how Python always has one way to do something versus how expressive Ruby is. And I thought that was a really interesting thing to say, because this might have been different in the early days before I started messing really with either, but it seems like the opposite now. In Python, there are a lot of different ways to do things. I mean, especially given the whole Python 2 versus Python 3 nightmare. But Rails is actually what brought convention over configuration to the mainstream in a lot of ways, where there is one true Rails way to do something. So I thought that was kind of interesting that one of his arguments, I don't want to say against Python, but one of the things he said that is an issue with it is that it forces you to always do things in the same way, when that does not seem to be the case at all to me.
Right. It was interesting when I read that too. I thought the same thing. I was thinking to myself, well, I guess he's talking about Ruby and not Rails, but I was thinking in the context of Rails, like even with Ruby, there's a way that they promote you should do something. And that's part of where most of the magic happens with Rails anyway.
Right. Even when we're just talking about Ruby, that's one of the things I really like about it, is that the community, for the most part, really, really has coalesced on what best practices are. So, I mean, even down to stuff like spaces versus tabs and how many spaces you should have, everyone, almost every single project in Ruby uses two spaces. That is very, very near universal.
I saw a tweet, maybe. I can look it up and put it in the show notes, but I think it was a tweet that was talking about that. They had a chart for a bunch of popular languages, and the chart was tabs versus spaces, how many repositories used one or the other. And Ruby, I think, was almost 100% spaces. And it was the only one by a landslide to be even that consistent.
Right. Yeah, you sent me that link. We'll definitely have to get that in show notes. It was pretty interesting. A lot of those languages were even languages where you would think, oh, this is all going to be set up the same way. Everybody's going to do the same thing. They were really split out. Like even in Objective-C, which is fairly on the four spaces side of things, it's only 80% of repositories. There's 12.5% that use tabs and 10% that use two spaces. Like there is a lot of dissent, but Ruby is almost 100% two tabs.
My favorite points in this article, or under the section, the menu is omakase. And there's safety in numbers, which basically means, you know, since Rails has such a strong convention or configuration mindset, everyone's kind of learning the same way and things are done the same way. So you can reach out to almost anybody that is working with Rails and you'll get a relatively similar answer, you know? Whereas in other languages, that's not the case. You can get pushed in many different directions, I'll just say. The second point was people are perfecting the same basic toolbox, which is also pretty true. You know, Rails has a bunch of tools that it comes with that mostly everyone uses. And the third point kind of goes along with point number two, but it says that substitutions are still possible, but not required. And I think this is my favorite part. You don't have to pick and choose all the different tools. So if you're learning Rails, it comes with an ORM, it comes with a router, it comes with all that stuff built in. So you don't have to go and do research about which tools are better than others. You can just use what it comes with.
Right. And I think all of these sort of fall under the whole convention over configuration umbrella. And that idea for me is really sort of most important when you're working with lots of different Rails code bases. I did consulting for a long time, as you know, worked in a consulting company. And when you're doing that, when you're starting on a new project every handful of months and need to pick it up quickly, when those are Rails projects and they're written out in the Rails way, it so drastically reduces ramp up time to have that convention in place where you know mostly where things live and you have an idea of how everything hooks together. It just saves so much time and lets you get to making Rails stuff sooner.
Right. It gives me more confidence when I go into a Rails code base that I've never used before. I mean, granted, we've both seen some pretty wild Rails, I guess people's interpretations of the Rails convention, right? But even still, you can reasonably be sure you're in the same ballpark, I guess. It's not something where you go into it and you're thinking to yourself, this is completely foreign and I have no idea where this code is coming from. Or at least I've never been in that situation with Rails.
Yeah, definitely. It's much harder to get to that point with Rails, I think.
Right. But at the same token, the substitutions are possible but not required. You know, if there's another tool that you think does something better, there's tons of Rails gems out there that are actually really good.
One thing that I actually kind of disagreed with pretty strongly in this article is the basically the defense of helper methods. And for anybody who doesn't know, Rails has the concept of helper methods where you'll have a Ruby file that you can write a set of functions in that then get exposed to your views for use there. So it can be used for a thing. A very simple example would be something like a full name method that accepted a user as an argument and then returned user.firstname plus space plus user.lastname. That's an extremely simple example, but it gets the concept across. And a lot of people have issues with helpers because it's just a giant pot of functions that live in the global scope and are pretty much globally accessible from any view and just don't have any namespacing done, which is awkward. And DHH in this article says how he's okay with that because essentially what he says is, in this case, I think PHP got it right. But in reality, I find that the lack of having namespaces for helpers, at the very least, that makes for a lot of unwieldy helper names. It doesn't actually improve anything versus having a namespace. It just means that you kind of end up namespacing things in the actual method names themselves. So I'm not sure I really see the benefit there. And overall, I think that the helpers in Rails are one of the weakest points of it.
Sure. You know, I've definitely used helpers before and found them useful, but I haven't ever been in a situation where I've had a lot of them. And at least enough of them to make me feel like this is kind of messy, right?
A lot of times I'll actually avoid using too many of them and either set up something like presenters or just other workarounds just because I find them so uncomfortable to use.
I find that I spring for simple methods on the model versus helper methods instead.
Right, which is not good. That's a lot of times what I end up doing as well. But then you're putting presentation logic into the model. But the way it exists right now, I feel like Rails actually does kind of encourage that because of how helpers are set up, which is not ideal.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. In the article, he actually says, what does he call it? PHP soup. It's just a giant pot of functions, right? And I think that definitely can be a problem. A lot of programmers always talk about how naming is the hardest thing, right? And so basically you're taking the hardest thing about programming and you're forcing yourself to do just that, to remove a little bit of soupness out of your herb templates. I mean, overall though, I like this. I like that Ruby on Rails has a doctrine. You know, I like that it advertises, hey, we do things a certain way. Especially because lately I've been learning more about programming along with others and having more than just a couple of programmers on a team doing things at the same time. And I'm learning how interesting and difficult that can be. So I find that the more structure I have and the more structure the people working beside me have, the better the outcome is. So I really like that Rails has this and they advertise it. So over the past couple of weeks, Paul, I've been looking for different cookbook style articles that I can share with the different people that I'm helping learn to program. So I found that there's a really big gap between learning a language like CSS and learning how to use it effectively, or even just learning patterns based around that, right? So for example, my mom has been programming for a little while now, And she's to the point now where she's pretty comfortable with CSS, and she can remember the syntax and write, you know, write CSS. But I think where she's at now, the biggest hindrance is not knowing how to implement designs. So what I've been doing is I've been getting a bunch of free PSDs and just having her make different repos for each one, and she'll code them up and she'll submit pull requests for me to check out. And by far the biggest hurdle is, you know, like looking at a design pattern and thinking like, well, how do I use CSS to make this? There's so many different ways to do this. So I've been looking around for cookbook type articles, things that show you how to do, I guess, different patterns, CSS patterns. But earlier I came across this repo called CSS Refresher Notes, and it's really awesome. It's just a collection of notes and observations and gotchas about CSS, and it's been really useful for me so far, and I sent it through. For example, the section on floats, it has a really thorough description of what floats are and why they're needed, but it also has 9 different rules that are basically 9 different gotchas saying, hey, this is how this works, and this is how you should approach this problem that you might run into, which I think is invaluable, because all of these little gotchas and rules are things that you almost have to learn from experience, right? By running into that situation.
Yeah, like you were saying, the biggest part of learning CSS isn't actually learning CSS, the syntax, the language. It's learning how to take a design idea, whether that's something in your head or a PSD you've been given or something else, and actually turn that into HTML and CSS that is sensible and works across a variety of browsers and screen sizes. That's really difficult because it's not something that can entirely be taught. A lot of it is trial and error, and a lot of these things aren't super well documented. Even when you go to, for example, MDN, which is a fantastic resource, it doesn't necessarily explain how this sort of stuff works in a very easy to grasp kind of way. So in CSS Refresher Notes under display, it explains what the different values are. And then for each of those values, it gives you examples and actually describes how it interacts with other properties. So for inline, it says, is subject vertical align, but ignores width and height. So it gives you a sense of how all of these things actually tie together, because they're not self-contained. Inline affects how a bunch of other CSS properties behave, or inline block, or block, etc. Especially with the displays, floats, positions, those are all very, very far-reaching in terms of what they touch in the rest of CSS. So having something that explains that network in a simple way is pretty awesome.
It also covers things like selector efficiency, where if you're just looking up different properties, you know, you might not come across something like this. And then below that, it gives an article that would help you optimize your selectors. And even better yet, right after that, it goes on to talk about repaints and reflows. And it breaks down what a repaint is versus what a reflow is. It gives a few bullet points on how to avoid both of those. And then below that, it gives you more reading so that way you can actually understand on a really great level what these two things are.
Yeah, so I think this is definitely a superb resource for anybody who's new to CSS or anybody who just kind of wants to make sure that they have all the details right. This is really cool. And reading through here, I've picked up a couple things as well, and I've been writing CSS for quite some time now. So I think this is just really, really cool and definitely worth checking out. So in kind of a similar vein, there is another repository called JS Tips, and it is, like you would expect, a set of JavaScript tips. Now, I just pulled this repository up again, and I had not noticed this before, but there is a super, super cool GIF at the top of this page. And honestly, it is worth checking out this repository just to watch this GIF, because it is awesome. Oh my God, it's so incredible.
Yeah, I've just been staring at it. That's why I talked about earlier. I talked about how cool it is that JS can run on pretty much everything, because I was staring at this GIF, imagining my JavaScript's running on all these devices.
Even if the rest of the repository didn't exist, I would still recommend taking a look at this GIF.
I think that there should, though, to make this more accurate, there should be a bucket of tears next to the computer where the source code is located.
Definitely. I mean, they're putting coffee into the computer. But no. Okay, everybody just go look at this GIF. It's awesome. It's so cool. But let's talk about the actual repository now a little bit. This is essentially, it does what it says on the tin. It's a list of JavaScript tips. What I really like about this is that a lot of these are actually tips about little weird idiosyncrasies of JavaScript that are extremely confusing to new developers and things that continue to get you for a long, long time after you've started to learn. This is stuff like hoisting and what that is in JavaScript, as well as stuff like the differences between undefined and null, because that's another one of those things where it's a very, very difficult to figure out at first and tough to keep in your head. But this has little examples and gives a bunch of great information about how to work with JS from day to day. I think this is so useful because, again, it's not so much about knowing the language, understanding the syntax. It's about actually using it in practice, which I think is so cool.
Sure. And a few of these things, you know, I would have typically done maybe with something like Lodash or underscore or something. But it's really awesome to understand how things like that work behind the scenes. I think I mentioned a few episodes ago about how Egghead has a series that breaks down JavaScript's array functions and re-implements them essentially. So I think any knowledge like that is almost essential.
All right, Sean, I know you've wanted to talk about this for a while, so we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about Otto, O-T-T-O, from HashiCorp. You can check this out at ottoproject.io, and of course, we'll also have a link in show notes. Otto is a tool that promises to make your development environment extraordinarily easy to set up and also handle your deployment. So it will allow you to develop on any machine just by running a single command, essentially. And there, of course, there are many tools, Vagrant, for instance, that already do that sort of thing. Otto is, as I said, it's also a HashiCorp product, and it is built on top of Vagrant. It's actually Vagrant's successor. But what it promises is a lot less configuration. It is, again, sort of like Rails, more of the convention over configuration sort of tool. And I think that's really amazing if it can be pulled off properly, especially for dev environments and deploying software, because those have historically been pretty difficult things to manage well. And I think it's awesome that more tools are being made in that vein, but we have to make sure that they actually work right. So the other night I spent probably like 5 hours playing with Otto. Because, you know, I was curious about it, and it's something that could save me a lot of time and a lot of headache down the road. And I have some thoughts on it, Sean.
First of all, can we just say all of HashiCorp's designs are super sick?
They are. They do such a good job. Yeah, very, very clean, but like just still really great to look at.
This promises a lot. And I've been tricked in the past, Paul, by marketing sites. Fancy marketing sites have been tricked. Especially when it comes to DevOps things, because I feel it's my weakest area. It's where I know the least about. But this seems really awesome. You know, I've been using Docker for 3-ish weeks, maybe a month now. And it's been okay. Deploying hasn't been any easier to me than Capistrano was before that. Maybe I'm doing something wrong, but that's how I feel about it. So when I look at Otto and how it says, for example, at the bottom, it says start your Rails project where you do Rails new. And then it says run auto compile. You literally run auto compile. And then it says dev locally, you run auto dev. That to me seems pretty awesome.
Yeah, definitely. So like I said, I spent a fair bit of time playing with this and that is super awesome. It's really kind of incredible. It just works. It detects your application without you having to write a single line of code or a single line of configuration. It figures out what type of app you're setting up, and it sets everything up with default best practices, and it's great. And when you run auto dev, it actually fires up a VM in the background, completely all set up correctly, And then you can just connect to that. It automatically syncs changes from your actual physical machine to that fake dev machine automatically, completely transparent. And it's great. It really does work super well. Also, when it comes time to deploy, you can actually deploy with this. And what it does by default is it sets up an entire system on AWS with EC2 machines talking to each other. And it actually sets up Consul, which is another HashiCorp product, for helping with service discovery. So all of your machines can find each other easily. It's really, really incredibly cool. And it can also tear down your environment. So it builds all these resources on AWS that are actual computing resources that you're paying money for. But when you're done, if you're just messing around with this, you actually can do, I think it's auto teardown or something like that. And it goes through and deprovisions all those resources. So it remembers how everything is set up and it automatically tears them down, which I thought was amazing. That felt so super cool.
I mean, that sounds incredible. Like I said, DevOps is probably my weakest area, even though I end up doing it quite a bit lately. This sounds like everything I wanted in setting up a dev environment, you know, allowing other developers, or if I have a front-end dev that maybe needs to help me out, I just say, hey, run this command and your stuff is set up. You know, I don't have to teach them how to fix the OpenSSL thing to get Event Machine to install, et cetera, et cetera. It just works, right?
Yeah, definitely. So it's very powerful and very awesome. And it feels like magic. It really does. It feels like magic until the point where it doesn't feel like magic anymore.
So you told me the TLDR was that wait 3 to 6 months and then use it for everything. Why can't I use it now? Because I really want to.
So I think right now, the biggest thing that you're going to run up against right away is the fact that it doesn't have any way to get your application configuration loaded into the app, which is kind of a big deal. That's something that pretty much any application is going to need, even down to the kind of level like getting your database configuration into your application. There's just not a great way to do that with auto right now. And obviously, every application is going to need some kind of configuration, at the very least for how it talks to its database. That's just something you're going to need pretty early on. And what they are working on right now is Vault integration. Now, Vault is yet another HashiCorp product, and Vault handles all of your secrets. So it's a great, great way, it's very powerful to handle anything from keys that you need for encrypting and decrypting things to passwords to pretty much anything that needs to stay a secret, but your apps need to access. Vault is the way to do that. And it's not easy to set up. It is relatively complicated, but once it's integrated into auto, which I believe they're hoping for the 0.3 release, which will be the next release, to have that integrated. Once it's integrated, that is going to be massive. It's going to make this so much more viable for so many different use cases. So I think as soon as that happens, this is going to be something that a lot of people should definitely check out.
So I basically can't even use it for dev at this point right now.
Nope.
I had to have to wait till Vault comes out.
Pretty much, yeah. That's my experience anyway. There probably are ways to get around this and kind of hack it together. But like I said, I spent about 5 hours messing with this the other night and a lot of time Googling about it. And there doesn't seem to be any great way to handle your application's config right now, which is a bummer. But at the same time, it's understandable. Auto does have a great foundation in place to move forward with. And I think that's the most important thing, really.
Right. I know the biggest barrier to entry for me when I was getting into backend development was a DevOps setup and trying to deploy a Rails app. So if Auto can deliver what it says, I think that's amazing because it would give people like me, you know, 2 years ago, a chance to actually deploy stuff that they're working on. And I would get so frustrated when I was trying to do this DevOps stuff. It would just discourage me, right? So hopefully, like I said, hopefully this can deliver and we'll see a lot more cool software coming out.
Yeah, and it's still very early days for Auto, so it's understandable that it's not totally production ready yet. I believe it just launched near the end of 2015. So they're only on the 0.2 release right now. And I think as soon as we get 0.3, 0.4, things are going to start leveling out a little bit. And it's going to be such a useful tool for a lot of different setups.
Well, I know it's definitely something that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, I think we're both going to be keeping an eye on it. And we'll probably talk about it as soon as 0.3 comes out again on the show, I would imagine.
We'll do a whole show dedicated to Otto, a celebration.
I can't wait, though. I'm really excited about that, and I can't wait to be able to use this for all of everything, because it is super magical when it's working.
I might try it a little later, just to try it. I just want to.
Yeah, at the very least, I think it's worth people checking out their getting started guide with their example application, because it does walk you through a lot of the basic concepts that are going to stay the same as things progress. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, definitely make sure to check that out. Another big thank you to Dev Bootcamp for supporting Does Not Compute. Dev Bootcamp helps you go from being a beginner to being able to build out the front and back end of your own web apps. They also help ensure you know how to use those skills in order to actually land a job. Check out devbootcamp.com/doesnotcompute to get all the details. We also want to say thanks to Hired for sponsoring us. If you're a designer or developer looking for a new job, Hired helps make it painless. It's free, you sign up, employers send you 5 or more interview requests per week, and when you decide to go with one of them, Hired gives you a $1,000 thank you bonus. Sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute and they'll double that bonus to $2,000. If you're enjoying Does Not Compute, please consider sharing it with a friend, giving a rating on iTunes, or just stopping by the Spec Slack to say hi. You can join at any time by going to spec.fm/slack.